Besides, there is a point where the unfortunate and the ignominious mingle and fuse, poor bastards, in a single word. A deadly word. Outcasts. Les Misérables. And whose fault is that? And then again, shouldn't charity be the greater, the deeper the fall into darkness? While he lectured himself in this vein, for there were times when Marius, like all truly honest souls, was his own schoolmaster, chastising himself more than he deserved, he studied the flimsy partition that separated him from the Jondrettes, as though he could drill his deeply compassionate gaze through it and warm those poor people up. The wall was nothing more than a thin layer of plaster, supported by laths and joists, and which, as we have just heard, allowed words and voices to be made out perfectly clearly. Only a dreamer like Marius could have failed to realize this already. There was no wallpaper pasted over the wall, either on the Jondrette's side or on Marius's. The crummy construction was laid bare for all to see. Almost without being aware of it, Marius examined the partition. Sometimes reverie examines, observes, scrutinizes much the same as thought would. Suddenly he bolted upright. Almost at the very top, near the ceiling, he spotted a triangular hole where three laths had left a gap between them. The rubble work that should have filled up this gap was not there, and by standing on the chest of drawers you could see through the hole into the Jondrette's garret. Commiseration has, and should have, its curiosity. This hole created a sort of Judas, a peephole. You are allowed to spy on misfortune as a traitor if you are going to relieve it. Let's take a bit of a peek at what these people are like, thought Marius, and see how bad things really are. He hopped up on the chest of drawers, put his eye to the crevice, and looked. Feral man in his lair. Towns, like forests, have their dens where the nastiest and most terrifying creatures they harbor hide. Only in towns, what hides like this is ferocious, filthy, and small, in other words, ugly. In forests, what hides is ferocious, wild, and big, that is, beautiful. As lairs go, those of beasts are preferable to those of men. Caves are better than rat holes. What Marius saw was a rat hole. Marius was poor, and his room was fairly bare, but just as his poverty was noble, his attic was clean. The pigsty he had a bird's-eye view of at that moment was abject, dirty, fetid, putrid, dark, sordid. All it had for furniture was a straw chair, a rickety table, a few old shards of pottery, and in two of the corners, two straw mattresses that defy description. All it had for light was a dormer window with four panes draped in cobwebs. There was just enough light coming in through this window for a man's face to appear like the face of a phantom. The walls had a leprous look and were covered in cuts and scars like a face disfigured by some horrible disease. They oozed a kind of roomy damp. Obscene drawings could be made out on them, roughly drawn in charcoal. The room Marius occupied was tiled with dilapidated, used bricks. This one had neither tiles nor floorboards. You walked straight on top of the tenement's undressed antique plaster, which had gone black from all the feet. On this uneven ground, where the dirt was more or less encrusted, and which was virgin soil only as far as the broom went, constellations of old shoes, ratty slippers, and awful rags were bunched willy-nilly. But the room had a fireplace, and so it was rented at 40 francs a year. There was a bit of everything in this fireplace, a stove, a cooking pot, some broken boards, rags hanging on nails, a birdcage, ashes, and even a bit of a fire. A tiny handful of embers was smoking away sadly. One thing added further to the garret's horror, and that was that it was big. It had projections, corners, black holes, recesses where the roof dipped down, bays and ridges jutting out. hence the frightening, unfathomable nooks and crannies where it seemed spiders as fat as your fist, woodlice as broad as your foot, and even perhaps some unspeakable human monsters had to be curled up snugly. One of the pallets was close to the door, the other close to the window. Both of them touched the hearth at one end and were facing Marius. In a corner next to the opening Marius was looking through, hanging on the wall in a black wooden frame, was a colored engraving at the bottom of which was written in capital letters, The Dream. This represented a sleeping woman and a sleeping child, the child on the woman's knee, an eagle in a cloud with a crown in its beak, and the woman taking the crown off the child's head and without its waking up, too. In the background, Napoleon in a blaze of glory was leaning on a fat blue column with a yellow capital adorned with this inscription, Marengo, Austerlitz, Jena, Wagram, Eylau. Below the framed engraving, a sort of wooden panel that was taller than it was wide had been placed on the floor leaning against the wall at an angle. This looked to be a painting turned round back to front, a stretcher probably daubed with paint on the other side, some kind of pier glass taken down from a wall and forgotten there, waiting to be hung back up again. At the table on which Malius spotted a pen and ink and some paper, a man about 60 was sitting. He was small, thin, livid, haggard, with a cunning, cruel and fretful look about him, a grisly evildoer. If Lavater had been able to study the man's face, he would have found in it the vulture mingled with the prosecutor, the bird of prey and the pettifogging shyster, bringing the worst out on each and completing each other, the shyster making the bird of prey ignoble, the bird of prey making the shyster appalling. The man had a long gray beard. He was dressed in a woman's chemise that exposed his hairy chest and his bare arms bristling with gray hair. Under the chemise you could make out mud-caked pants and boots with his toes sticking out. He had a pipe clamped in his mouth and was puffing on it. There may have been no bread left in the rat-hole, but there was still some tobacco. He was writing, probably, a letter like the ones Marius had read. On one corner of the table was an old, odd volume with a reddish cover. Its format, which was the old duodecimo of reading rooms, revealed a novel. On the cover, the title spread in bold capital letters, God, the King, Honor, and the Ladies, by Ducret d'Aumesnil, 1814. While he wrote, the man talked out loud, and Marius heard what he said. To think there's no equality. Not even when you're dead. You've only got to look at Père Lachaise. The bigwigs, the knobs, are at the top, along the pathway where the acacias are, where it's paved. They get to arrive in a carriage. The little people, the poor people, the unlucky, in a word, they're stuck at the bottom, where there's mud up to your knees, in holes, in the muck. They put them there so they'll rot faster. You can't go and see them without getting stuck in the ground. Here he stopped, banged the table with his fist, and added, grinding his teeth, Oh, I could eat the whole rotten world. A big woman, who could have been anywhere between 40 and 100, was squatting on her bare heels close to the fire. She, too, was dressed in a chemise as well as a knitted woolen skirt patched with bits of old sheeting. An apron of coarse canvas hid half the skirt. Although this woman was bent double, crouching and hugging herself, you could see that she was very tall. Next to her husband she was a kind of giant. She had awful hair, a rusty blonde going grey, and she pushed it back now and again with her enormous, shiny, flat-nailed hands. Lying next to her on the floor, wide open, was a volume of the same format as the other one, and probably of the same novel. On one of the pallets, Marius glimpsed a sort of skinny, whey-faced girl sitting almost naked, with her feet dangling, looking as though she couldn't hear or see and was not, in fact, alive. No doubt the younger sister of the one who had come to his room. She looked 11 or 12. If you studied her more closely, you would see that she was, in fact, 15. This was the child who had said, the night before on the boulevard, Did I make a run for it? She was of that sickly species that remains backward for a long time, then suddenly grows up fast. It is destitution that produces these sad human plants. Creatures who don't have a childhood or an adolescence either. At 15, they look 12. At 16, they look 20. Today, little girls, tomorrow, mature women. It is as though they bounded through life to get it over with faster. At that moment, this being still looked like a child. Whatever the case, nothing in the room pointed to any kind of work whatever, no tools of a trade, no loom, no spinning wheel, no implement. In one corner there were a few dubious-looking bits of scrap iron. It was full of the forlorn indolence that follows despair and precedes the last gasp. Malus gazed for some time at this funereal interior, more terrifying than the inside of a tomb, for you could feel the human soul stirring there and life pulsating still. The garret, the cellar, the dungeon where certain of the destitute crawl at the bottom of the social edifice, is not yet quite the sepulchre. It is its antechamber, but like rich people who display their greatest riches at the entrance to their palace, it seems that death, which is close at hand, puts its greatest miseries in this, its vestibule. The man had shut up. The woman wasn't speaking. The young girl seemed not to be breathing. You could hear the pen scratching, screeching, screaming across the page. The man grumbled without ceasing to write, "Mongrels, mongrels are all mongrels." This variation on Solomon's cry got a sigh from the woman.
"Calm down, pet," she said. "Don't upset yourself, dear heart. You're too good to write to all these people, treasure."
In misery, bodies huddled together against the rest, just as they do in the cold, but hearts grow distant. This woman, as far as anyone could tell, must once have loved this man with whatever quotient of love was in her. But most likely, in the daily mutual rage provoked by the awful distress that ground the family down, that love had died. There was nothing left in her for her husband except the cold ashes of affection. But terms of endearment, as so often, had survived. She called him pet, dear heart, treasure, etc., with her lips. Her heart said nothing. The man had returned to his writing. Strategies and Tactics. Malus, with heavy heart, was about to climb back down from this observatory he had improvised, when a noise attracted his attention and made him stay right where he was. The garret door had just swung open violently. The elder daughter appeared on the landing. She had a man's outsized clodhoppers on her feet, and they were caked in mud, which had been spattered right up her reddened ankles, and she was cloaked in an old, tattered mantle that Marius had not seen on her an hour ago, but that she had probably unloaded at his door in order to inspire more pity, and then picked up again when she left. She came in, shut the door behind her, stopped to catch her breath, for she was quite winded, then shouted with an expression of triumph and joy, "He's coming!" The father turned his eyes to her, the mother turned her head. The little sister did not stir. "Who?" asked the father.
"The gent."
"The philanthropist?"
"Yep."
"From the Saint-Jacques church?"
"Yep."
"The old geezer?"
"Yep."
"He's coming?"
"He's right behind me."
"Are you sure?"
"I'm sure."
"Just like that, you mean? He's coming?"
"He's coming in a cab."
"In a cab. Must be Rothschild." The father got up. "How can you be so sure? If he's coming in a cab, how come you got here first? You did give him the address, at least. You did tell him the last door on the right at the end of the hall. Let's hope he doesn't get it wrong. So you found him at the church. Did he read my letter? What did he say?"
"Tut, tut, tut," said the girl. "God, you do go on, old man. Here's the story. I go into the church. He's at his usual place. I give him a curtsy, and I hand him the letter. He reads it, and he says, 'Where do you live, my child?' I say, 'Monsieur, I'll take you there.' He says, 'No, give me your address. My daughter has some shopping to do. I'll take a carriage, and I'll get to your place the same time as you.' I give him the address. When I told him which house, he looked surprised, and he hesitated for a second. Then he said, "It doesn't matter. I'll come anyway." When Mass was over, I saw him walk out of the church with his daughter, and I saw them hop in a cab. And I did tell him the last door on the right at the end of the hall.
"And what makes you think he'll come?"
"I just saw the cab turning into the Rue du Petit Banquier. That's why I came running."
"How do you know it's the same cab?"
"Because I noted the number, that's how."
"What's the number?"
440.
"Good. You're a smart girl."
The girl gave her father a defiant look, and showing the shoes she had on her feet, she said,
"A smart girl, maybe, but I'm telling you now, I'm never putting these shoes on again. And I won't have anything more to do with them, for health reasons, to start with, and then for decency's sake. I don't know what could be more annoying than soles that ooze and go swish, swish, swish all the way down the street. I'd rather go barefoot."
"Right you are," replied the father, in a gentle tone that contrasted with the young girl's abrasiveness. "But then they won't let you set foot in a church. The poor have to have shoes. You don't go to the house of the Lord barefoot," he added bitterly. Then he returned to the subject on his mind.
"But you're sure, then, you're sure he's coming?"
"He's hot on my heels," she said.
The man straightened up, his face lit up with a strange inner glow.
"Woman," he cried, "you hear that? The philanthropist's coming. Put the fire out."
The stupefied mother didn't budge. The father, with the agility of an acrobat, grabbed a jug with a broken neck that was sitting on the hearth and threw water on the embers. Then he turned to his elder daughter.
"You, strip the straw off the chair."
His daughter didn't know what he meant. He took hold of the chair and, with a swift thrust of his heel, kicked the straw out. His leg went right through it. As he pulled his leg out, he asked his daughter, "Is it cold out?"
"Bitterly cold. It's snowing."
The father turned to the younger daughter, who was on the pallet by the window, and bellowed at her in a thundering voice,
"Quick, off the bed, you good-for-nothing lump! Can't you do something for a change? Smash a bloody windowpane!"
The little girl hopped off the bed, shivering.
"Smash a windowpane!" he repeated.
The child was speechless.
"You heard me,"
the father yelled.
"I told you to smash a windowpane."
In a sort of terrified act of obedience, the child stood on tiptoe and punched her fist into a windowpane. The glass shattered and fell with a crash.
"Good,"
said the father. He was grave and abrupt. He ran his eyes rapidly over all the nooks and crannies of the garret, like a general making his final preparations as the battle was about to begin. The mother, who had not yet uttered a word, got to her feet and asked in a slow, thick voice, in words that seemed to come out congealed,
"Darling, what do you want to do?"
"You hop into bed," replied the man. His tone did not admit of any deliberation. The mother obeyed and threw herself heavily onto one of the pallets. Meanwhile, a sob was heard in a corner.
"What's that?"
shouted the father. The younger daughter, without coming out of the shadows she had sought refuge in, showed her bleeding fist. She had hurt herself, breaking the glass, and now she was at her mother's bed, quietly crying. It was the mother's turn to stand up and yell,
"Now look what you've done! God, you think up some stupid things! She's cut herself, breaking your stupid window for you!"
"Well and good," said the man. "That was the idea."
"What do you mean, well and good?"
the mother shot back.
"Quiet,"
replied the father.
"I suppress the freedom of the press."
Then, ripping the woman's chemise he was wearing, he tore off a strip and promptly wrapped the little girl's bleeding hand tightly with it. That done, he glanced down at his torn chemise with satisfaction.
"The chemise, while we're at it," he said, "it all looks pretty good."
An icy wind whistled at the window and swept into the room. The fog outside rolled in and spread out like whitish cotton wool vaguely pulled apart by invisible fingers. Through the broken window you could see snow falling. The cold promised the day before by the Candlemas sun had arrived with a vengeance. The father ran his eye one last time around him as though to reassure himself that he had not forgotten anything. He took an old shovel and spread the ash over the wet embers so as to hide them completely. Then he stood up again and leaned back against the fireplace.
"Now," he said, "we're ready to receive the philanthropist."
A ray of light in the rat hole. The big girl went over and put her hand on her father's hand.
"Feel how cold I am," she said.
"Bah," the father responded, "I'm a lot colder than that."
The mother cried impetuously,
"You always have to go on better than everyone else, don't you? Even when it comes to pain."
"Down,"
said the man.
At a certain look from the man, the mother shut up. There was a moment of silence in the rat hole. The elder daughter was scraping the mud off the hem of her mantle. The younger sister went on sobbing. The mother had taken the girl's head in both hands and was covering it with kisses, whispering to her,
"Now, now, my treasure, it's nothing. Don't cry. You'll make your father angry."
"No," cried the father. "On the contrary, bawl your eyes out. Sob. That's just a ticket."
Then turning back to the elder girl, "Well, then, he's not coming. What if he's not coming? I will have put out my fire, kicked in my chair, ripped my chemise, and broken my window all for nothing."
"And hurt the little one,"
the mother murmured. "Do you know," the father went on, "it's as cold as a nun's nasty in this dump of a place.
If this bastard doesn't show up, he's said to himself, 'Well, then, let them wait, that's what they're there for.' Oh, how I hate them. How I would love to strangle every one of them, gleefully, joyfully, enthusiastically, happily, the bleeding rich. Every last one of them. These so-called charitable types who make chutney, go to mass, go in for the priesthood, preach this, preach that, churchy types who think they're above us, and come to humiliate us and bring us their cast-offs. That's what they call them. Togs not worth 4 sous and bread. That's not what I want. You pile of steaming turds, I want money. Ah, money, never, because they say we'll just go and drink it all. We're nothing but drunks and layabouts.
What about them? What are they, then, and what were they in their day?
Thieves. They wouldn't have got rich otherwise. Ah, we ought to take society by the four corners of the tablecloth and toss the whole lot in the air. Everything would smash to smithereens, most likely. But at least then no one would have anything, and that'd be something. But what can he be doing, then? Your boor of a benevolent gent. Is he going to come? The stupid bastard's probably forgotten the address. I bet that old idiot."
At that moment, there was a gentle rap at the door. The man lunged toward it and opened it, offering smiles of adoration as he scraped and bowed.
"Come in, monsieur, deign to come in, my respectable benefactor, along with your charming young lady."
A man of mature age and a young girl appeared in the doorway of the garret. Malleus had not left his place. What he felt at that moment is beyond the power of human language to tell. Her, anyone who has ever loved, knows all the radiant meaning packed into the three letters of that word. Her. It really was her. Malleus could barely make her out through the luminous haze that suddenly spread over his eyes. It was that sweet, absent being, that star that had shone for 6 months, those eyes, that forehead, that mouth, that beautiful, vanished face that had brought down the night in vanishing. The vision had been eclipsed. She reappeared. She reappeared in this darkness, in this garret, in this diseased dump of a place, in this horror. Malleus shuddered uncontrollably.
What? Her?
His heart was beating so hard he could hardly see. He felt he was about to burst into tears. What? He was finally seeing her again after searching for her for so long. It felt as if he'd lost his soul and had now suddenly found it again. She was the same as ever. A bit paler, only. Her delicate face was framed by a hat of violet velvet. Her figure was hidden under a pelisse of black satin. Under her long frock, you could see her tiny feet, shod in silk brodequin. She was still accompanied by Monsieur Leblanc. She had taken a few steps into the room and had placed a fairly large parcel on the table. The elder Jondrette girl had retreated behind the door and eyed the velvet hat darkly, along with the silk mantle and the lovely, happy face. Jondrette very nearly weeps. The rat hole was so dark that anyone coming in from outside felt like they were entering a cellar. The two new arrivals accordingly advanced somewhat tentatively, barely making out the dim shapes around them while being seen and examined perfectly well by the garret residents, whose eyes were accustomed to this eternal twilight.
Monsieur Leblanc approached with his kind, sad eyes and said to Father Jondrette, "Monsieur, you will find new clothes, woolen stockings, and blankets in this parcel.
Our angelic benefactor overwhelms us," said Jondrette, bowing to the floor.
Then, bending down to whisper in his elder daughter's ear while the two visitors were examining the lamentable interior, he added swiftly,
"See, what did I tell you? Rags, no money. They're all the same. Speaking of which, how was the letter to this old codger signed?"
"Fabantou," she replied.
"The dramatic artiste, right?"
Lucky Jondrette had asked for at that very moment. Monsieur Leblanc turned to him and said, as though searching for his name, "I see that you really are to be pitied, monsieur."
"Fabantou,"
Jondrette quickly cut in.
"Monsieur Fabantou, yes, that's right, I remember. Dramatic artiste, monsieur. One who has had his successes."
Here Jondrette evidently felt the moment had come to close in on the philanthropist. He shouted in a voice combining the vainglory of the fairground tumbler with the humility of the high street beggar all in one.
"Student of Talma, monsieur, I'm a student of Talma. Fortune once smiled on me, alas. Now it's misfortune's turn. You see, my benefactor, no bread, no fire. My poor kiddies have no fire. My only chair has the bottom out of it, a broken windowpane. In this weather, my missus in bed, sick."
"Poor woman," said Monsieur Leblanc.
"My child hurt,"
Jondrette added. The child, distracted by the arrival of the strangers, was busy staring at the young lady and had stopped her sobbing.
"Go on, cry, bawl,"
Jondrette hissed at her. At the same time he pinched her sore hand, all with the skill of a conjurer, the little girl let out a few loud shrieks. The adorable young girl, whom Marius in his heart called his Ursula, ran over.
"You poor dear child," she said.
"You see, my beautiful young lady," Jondrette went on, "her bleeding wrist. It was an accident that happened while she was working away on a machine, just to make 6 sous a day. They may be forced to cut her arm off."
"Really?" said the old gentleman, alarmed. The little girl, taking this remark seriously, began to wail again, louder than ever, quite beautifully.
"Alas, yes, my benefactor," the father replied.
For some moments, Jondrette had been studying the philanthropist in a bizarre way. Even as he spoke, he was scrutinizing the man with intense attention, as though he were trying to gather his memories together. All of a sudden, taking advantage of a moment when the newcomers were keenly questioning the little girl about her injured hand, he went over to the bed where his wife was, looking dopey and out of her depth, and he quickly whispered to her,
"Take a good look at that man, will you?"
Then he turned back to Monsieur Leblanc and continued his lament.
"You see, monsieur, all I have myself for clothes is one of my wife's chemises, and it's all torn in the middle of winter. I can't go out without a coat. If I had a coat of some sort, I'd go and see Mademoiselle Mars, who knows me and who is really fond of me. Doesn't she still live in the Rue de la Tour des Dames? Do you know, monsieur, we used to tour together in the country. I shared her laurels. Célimène would come to my aid, monsieur. Elmire would give alms to Belisarius, but no, nothing, and not a sou in the house. My wife sick, and not a sou. My daughter dangerously injured, and not a sou. The missus has coughing fits. It's her age, and then again, the nervous system's got something to do with it. She needs help, and my daughter too, but we can't afford doctors or chemists. How can we pay? Not a centime. I'd go down on my knees for a 10 centime piece, monsieur. You see what the arts have been reduced to. And do you know, my charming young lady, and you, monsieur, generous patron of mine, do you know, you who breathe virtue and goodness, and who perfume the church where my poor daughter goes to say her prayers and sees you every day? For I bring my daughters up in the church, monsieur. I didn't want them to take to the theatre. The little scamps. If I see them batting an eyelid, I'm not kidding. No, sir, I hit him with a bit of sound and fury about honour and morality and virtue. Ask them. They have to stick to the straight and narrow. They've got a father. They're not like those poor, unfortunate girls who start off not having a family and end up taking on all comers. When you're Mamselle Nobody, you become Madame Everybody. Jumping Jehovah, none of that in the Fabantou family. I mean to educate them virtuously, and for 'em to be honest, and for 'em to be nice, and for 'em to believe in God.
Good God! Well, then, monsieur, my worthy monsieur, do you know what is going to happen tomorrow? Tomorrow is the 4th of February. That fatal day, the last day my landlord has given me. If I haven't paid by this evening, tomorrow my eldest daughter, me, my missus with her fever, my little girl with her injury, we will all four be evicted, kicked out, thrown on the street, on the boulevard, without shelter, in the rain, in the snow. There, you have it, monsieur. I owe 4 quarters, a whole year. That is 60 francs. Jondrette was lying. 4 quarters would have meant only 40 francs. And he could not owe 4 quarters, since only 6 months ago Marius had paid 2. Monsieur Leblanc pulled 5 francs out of his pocket and put them on the table. Jondrette had time to mumble into his big girl's ear, "Bastard, what does he want me to do with his 5 francs? That won't pay for my chair and my window. All that for nothing." But Monsieur Leblanc had taken off the big brown greatcoat he had been wearing over his blue redingote and thrown it over the back of the chair. "Monsieur Fabantou," he said, "I have only those 5 francs on me, but I'm going to take my daughter home, and I'll return this evening. It's this evening, isn't it, that you have to pay?" Jondrette's face lit up with a strange expression. He quickly answered, "Yes, my estimable gentleman, at 8 o'clock. I have to be at my landlord's door. I'll be here at 6 o'clock, and I'll bring you the 60 francs. "My benefactor!" cried Jondrette, overcome. And he added in a whisper, "Take a good look at him, woman." Monsieur Leblanc had taken the arm of the beautiful young girl again and turned toward the door. "Till this evening, my friends," he said. 6 o'clock," said Jondrette. 6 on the dot. At that moment, the greatcoat left on the chair caught the eye of the elder Jondrette girl. "Monsieur," she said, "you've forgotten your overcoat." Jondrette looked daggers at his daughter and gave a fearful shrug of the shoulders. Monsieur Leblanc turned round and answered with a smile, "I haven't forgotten it. I'm leaving it." "Oh, my patron," said Jondrette, "my august benefactor, I am dissolving into tears. Please allow me to take you back to your cab." "If you go out," rejoined Monsieur Leblanc, "put this overcoat on. It is very cold." Jondrette did not need to be told twice. He swiftly threw the brown greatcoat on, and the three of them went out, Jondrette ahead of the two strangers. Rates for cabs, 2 francs an hour. Marius had missed nothing of this whole scene, and yet in reality he had seen nothing. His eyes had remained glued to the young girl. His heart had, so to speak, seized her and enveloped her from head to toe the moment she stepped into the garret. The whole time she was there, he had lived that life of ecstasy that suspends material perceptions and causes the whole soul to rush to one point. He contemplated not the girl, but the light which wore a satin pelisse and a velvet hat. If Sirius the star had entered the room, he could not have been more dazzled. While the young girl was opening the parcel and unfolding the clothes and the blankets, or questioning the sick mother so kind-heartedly and the little injured girl so tender-heartedly, he was watching her every move very closely and straining to hear what she said. He knew her eyes, her forehead, her beauty, her figure, her gait, but he did not know the sound of her voice. He thought he'd caught a few words once at the Luxembourg, but he was not absolutely sure. He'd have given 10 years of his life to hear it, to be able to carry a bit of that music in his soul. But it was lost in all these lamentable performances and Jondrette's trumpeting. This added rage to Marius's rapture. He gazed longingly at her. He could not quite believe that it really was this divine creature that he was seeing amid these depraved beings in this monstrous hole. It was like seeing a hummingbird among toads. When she left, he had only one thought: to follow her, to hug her tracks, not to let her go until he'd found out where she lived, not to lose her again, at least after having so miraculously found her again. He jumped down from the chest of drawers and grabbed his hat. Just as he placed his hand on the doorknob and was about to go out, a thought made him stop short. The hall was long, the staircase narrow. Jondrette was a talker. Monsieur Leblanc had no doubt not yet stepped back up into his carriage. If he turned round in the hall or on the stairs or at the doorstep and saw Marius in this house, obviously he would be alarmed and would find a way of escaping yet again, and would all be finished yet again. What could he do? Wait a while? But while he was waiting, the cab might take off. Marius didn't know what to do. Finally, he took the risk and left his room. There was nobody in the hall now. He ran to the stairs. There was nobody on the stairs either. He rushed downstairs and reached the boulevard just in time to see a fiacre turning the corner of the Rue du Petit Banquier to go back to Paris. Marius hurried in that direction. When he reached the corner of the boulevard, he saw the same cab going at quite a clip down the Rue Mouffetard. The cab was already a long way off. There was no way he could catch up with it. What did he imagine? That he'd run after it? Hardly. Besides, inside the cab they would surely notice this individual running for all his might in hot pursuit of them, and the father would recognize him. Just then, an unbelievable and marvelous stroke of luck, Marius saw a cab for hire going past on the boulevard, empty. There was only one thing to do, and that was to hop in this cab and follow the other one. This was safe, effective, and free of danger. Marius signaled the driver to stop and shouted at him, "By the hour!" Marius didn't have a cravat on. He was in his shabby old work coat, which had buttons missing, and his shirt was torn along one of the folds at the front. The driver pulled up, winked, and held out his left hand to Marius, gently rubbing his index finger with his thumb. "What?" said Marius. "Pay up front," said the driver. Marius remembered he had only 16 sous on him. "How much?" he asked. 40 sous. "I'll pay you when I get back." The driver, by way of response, simply whistled the tune of La Police and whipped his horse into action. Marius watched the cabriolet driving away, distraught. For want of 24 sous, his joy, his happiness, his love, was slipping through his fingers. He was sliding back into the gloom. He had seen, and now he would be blind again. He thought bitterly, and, it must be said, with deep regret, of the 5 francs he had given that pig of a girl that very morning. If he had had those 5 francs, he would be saved. He would be born again. He would emerge from limbo and darkness. He would shed his loneliness and his spleen and his mourning for his lost love. He would have tied the knot once more between the black thread of his destiny and this beautiful gold thread that had just floated before his very eyes, only to snap once more. He went back into the crumbling slum in despair. He could have told himself that Monsieur Leblanc had promised to return that evening, and that he only needed to be better prepared this time to follow him, but in his gloomy contemplation he had hardly registered this. Just as he was going upstairs, he saw on the other side of the boulevard, walking along by the deserted wall of the Rue de la Barrière des Gobelins, Jondrette, wrapped up in the coat of a philanthropist, talking to one of those disturbing-looking men who are appropriately known as prowlers of the barrière. Rough men with ambiguous faces, given to dubious monologues and evil schemes, who routinely sleep during the day, from which you have to assume they work at night. The 2 men, chatting away, standing stock still in the snow that was swirling down, formed an association that a police sergeant would definitely have kept his eye on, but that Marius barely noticed. Yet, whatever his painful preoccupation, he could not help remarking to himself that the barrière prowler Jondrette was talking to looked very like a certain Panchaud, alias Printanier, alias Bigrenaille, whom Courfeyrac had once pointed out to him and who passed in the quartier for a pretty dangerous night rambler. We saw this man's name in the preceding book. This Panchaud, alias Printanier, alias Bigrenaille, later featured in several criminal proceedings and has since become a celebrity crook. At the time he was still only a notorious crook. Today he is a part of the tradition among gangsters and murderers. He had a real following toward the close of the last reign, and in the evening at nightfall, at the hour when groups huddle together and speak in hushed voices, they used to talk about him in the exercise yard called the Lion's Den at La Force. At that fabled prison, at the exact spot under the covered way where the sewer runs that was used in the incredible breakout in broad daylight of 30 detainees in 1843. You could even read, above the flagstones of the toilets, his name, Panchaud, boldly carved by the man himself on the parapet wall in one of his attempts at escape. In 1832, the police already had him under surveillance, but he had not yet seriously made his debut. Misery offers pain its services. Marius climbed upstairs slowly. The moment he was about to go back to his cell, he saw in the hallway behind him the elder Jondrette girl following him. This girl was odious in his sight. She was the one who had his 5 francs, and it was too late to ask her to give them back. The cabriolet was no longer there. The fiacre was far away. She wouldn't give them back to him anyway. As for quizzing her about where the people who had come a moment ago lived, that was pointless. It was obvious she didn't know, since the letter signed Fabantou was addressed to the benevolent gentleman of the Church of Saint-Jacques d'Aubas. Marius stepped into his room and slammed the door shut behind him. It did not close. He turned round and saw that a hand was keeping it open. "What is it?" he asked. "Who's there?" It was the Jondrette girl.
"It's you," said Marius almost harshly. "You again. What do you want this time?"
She seemed pensive and did not answer. She had lost the morning's confidence. She did not come in, but stood in the shadows in the hall where Marius saw her through the half-open door.
"Come on, spit it out," said Marius. "What do you want?"
She lifted her forlorn eyes to him, a spark of life seeming to ignite in them, and said,
"Monsieur Marius, you look sad. What's wrong?"
"Me?" said Marius.
"Yes, you."
"Nothing's wrong."
"Yes, it is."
"No, it's not."
"I'm telling you it is. Leave me alone."
Marius tried to shut the door again, but she continued to hold it open.
"Listen," she said, "you're wrong. Even though you're not rich. You were kind this morning. Be kind again now. You gave me something to eat with. Tell me now what's the matter. You're upset. Anyone can see that. What can be done to help? Can I do something? Put me to use. I'm not asking you for your secrets. You don't need to tell me, but, well, I can be useful. I can help you. I help my father. When someone has to carry letters, go into houses, go from door to door, find an address, follow someone, well, I'm the one that does it. So then, you can tell me what's wrong. I'll go and talk to certain persons. Sometimes a body just has to speak to certain persons, and that's enough to find out things, and everything's set right. Use me."
An idea came to Marius. "Is there a straw we won't clutch at when we feel ourselves drowning?" He went over to the Jondrette girl.
"Listen," he said.
She promptly cut in with a flash of joy in her eyes.
"Oh, yes, tell me. That's better."
"Well, then," he went on, "you know that old gentleman that you brought here with his daughter?"
"Yes."
"Do you know their address?"
"No."
"Find out for me."
The Jondrette girl's eyes had gone from forlorn to joyful, and from joyful to grim.
"So that's what you're after?"
"Yes."
"Do you know them?"
"No."
"So what you're saying is,"
she went on sharply,
"you don't know her, but you'd like to know her."
That shift from them to her was dripping with innuendo and bile.
"Well, can you do it?" said Marius.
"Get you the address of the lovely young lady?"
There was again in those words, "the lovely young lady," a tone that irritated Marius. He went on.
"Does it matter? The address of the father and the daughter, their address. No?"
She glared at him.
"What'll you give me?"
"Whatever you like."
"Whatever I like?"
"Yes."
"You'll get the address."
She looked down, then promptly pulled the door shut. Marius found himself alone again. He dropped onto a chair and leaned forward with both elbows on the bed, and his head in both hands, sunk in thoughts he could not grasp, as though he were having a dizzy spell. Everything that had happened since that morning,
the appearance of the angel, her disappearance, what this creature had just said to him, which was like a ray of hope bobbing on an ocean of despair. His brain was filled with this giddy jumble. Suddenly he was jolted violently out of his reverie. He heard the high, hard voice of Jondrette utter these words full of strangely intense interest for him.
"I tell you, I'm sure of it. I recognized him."
Who was Jondrette talking about? He recognized who? Monsieur Leblanc? The father of his Ursula? What? Did Jondrette know him? Was Marius about to have all the information without which his life was meaningless to him through this sudden and unexpected channel? Was he about to find out at last who it was he loved? Who this young girl was, who her father was? Was that incredibly dense shadow that cloaked them about to be dispersed by light? Was the veil about to be lifted? Ah, heavens above! He sprang rather than climbed up on the chest of drawers and resumed his place by the hole in the wall. Once more the interior of the Jondrette rat hole came into view. Use of Monsieur Leblanc's 5-franc piece. Nothing had changed in the family's appearance except that the woman and the girls had thrown themselves on the parcel and pulled on stockings and woolen camisoles. 2 brand new blankets had been thrown over the 2 beds. Old man Jondrette had evidently just got back. He was still winded by his trip outside. His daughters were by the fireside, sitting on the ground, the elder bandaging the younger's hand. His wife was slumped on the pallet next to the fireplace, with amazement written all over her face. Jondrette paced up and down the garret, taking great strides. His eyes were crazed. The woman, who seemed timid and dumbstruck in front of her husband, risked a question. "Is that right? Are you sure?"
"Sure. It was 8 years ago, but I recognize him. I recognize him, all right. I recognized him right off." "What, didn't it hit you in the face?"
"No.
Yet I told you to pay attention." "But it's the height, the face. He hasn't aged a bit. There are people who don't age. I don't know how they do it. It's the sound of his voice. He's better turned out, that's all." "Ah, you old devil of a mystery man. I've got you now, all right."
He stopped and said to his daughters,
"Get lost, you two. It's funny it didn't hit you right in the face."
The girls got up to do as they were told. The mother stammered,
"With her sore hand?"
"The air'll do her good," said Jondrette. "Go on."
It was clear that this man was one of those you do not answer back. The 2 girls left. Just as they were going out the door, the father grabbed hold of the elder's arm and said in a very peculiar tone,
"You'll be back here at 5 o'clock sharp, both of you. I'll be needing you."
Marius's attention intensified. Now that he was alone with his wife, Jondrette resumed pacing the room, and he circled it 2 or 3 times in silence. Then he spent a few moments tucking the woman's chemise he was wearing into his pants and doing them up tighter. All of a sudden, he spun around to Mother Jondrette, folded his arms, and yelled,
"And another thing! That young lady!"
"What about her?"
the woman shot back.
"What about the young lady?"
Marius could be in no doubt. They were clearly talking about her. He listened with ardent anxiety. His whole life was throbbing in his ears. But Jondrette had bent down and practically whispered to his wife. Then he straightened up and said very loudly,
"It's her!"
"That?"
said the wife.
"That,"
said the husband. Words could not express all that was packed into the mother's "that." There was surprise, rage, hate, anger, mixed and blended in a monstrous intonation. All that it took was a few words uttered by her husband, the name, no doubt, that her husband had whispered in her ear for this big, sleepy woman to wake up and shift from repulsive to appalling.
"Can't be," she cried, "when I think that my girls go barefoot and don't have a dress between them. You've got to be kidding. A satin pelisse, a velvet hat, silk brodequin, the works. More than 200 francs worth, like she was a blasted princess. No, you've got it mixed up. To start with, that other thing was a fright. This one isn't too bad. Not too bad at all. It can't be her. I tell you, it is her. You'll see."
In the face of such absolute assertion, Mother Jondrette lifted her big, ruddy, blonde head and looked up at the ceiling with a twisted expression. At that moment, She struck Marius as even more frightening than her husband. She was a sow with the eyes of a tigress.
"You've got to be kidding," she went on. "That horrible, beautiful young lady who looked at my girls with pity in her eyes. You reckon she's that little frump? Oh, I'd like to kick her guts in with hobnailed boots."
She leaped out of bed and stood there for a moment, hair in a tangle, nostrils flaring, mouth gaping, fists clenched and drawn up. Then she dropped back onto the pallet. The man paced up and down without paying the slightest attention to his female. After a few seconds' silence, he went over to Mother Jondrette and stood facing her with his arms folded, as he had done a moment before.
"And you know what else?"
"What?" she asked. He answered in a short, low voice. "My fortune's made." Mother Jondrette studied him with a look that said, "Has this man talking to me gone stark raving mad?" He continued. "Holy hell, I've been a member of the down-and-out club a bit too long now. I've had a gut full of misery. I've had my share, more than my share. I'm not joking around anymore. I don't find it funny anymore. Enough wordplay, for Christ's sake. No more farces, Heavenly Father. I want to eat my fill. I want to drink my fill. Wolf it down. Sleep. Laze around, doing nothing. I want my turn. Do you get it? Before I croak, I'd like to be a bit of a millionaire, too." He circled the rat hole before adding, "Like other people."
"What do you mean?" the woman asked.
He shook his head, winked, and raised his voice in the manner of a roving medicine man about to give a demonstration in the street.
"What do I mean? I'll tell you what I mean."
"Shush," growled Mother Jondrette. "Not so loud. This isn't something anyone else should hear about."
"Bah, who? The neighbor? I saw him go out a while ago."
"Besides, do you think he listens in, that great booby? And anyway, I told you, I saw him go out." Yet out of a sort of instinct, Jondrette lowered his voice, though not enough for his words to escape Marius. A favorable circumstance that allowed Marius not to lose any of this conversation was that the fallen snow muffled the noise of carriages on the boulevard. Here is what Marius heard.
"Listen carefully. We've got him, this Croesus. As good as. It's in the bag, it's all arranged. I saw some people. He's coming here at 6 o'clock tonight, bringing his 60 francs, the mongrel. Did you see how I pulled that out of the bag for you, my 60 francs? My landlord, my 4th of February, it's not even a quarter yet."
Talk about stupid. "So he'll be here at 6 o'clock. That's when the neighbor goes out to dinner. Mother Bougon goes and does the dishes in town. There's no one in the house. The neighbor never gets back before 11. The girls can keep a lookout. You'll help us. He'll go along and hang himself."
"And what if he doesn't go along?" asked the woman.
Jondrette made a sinister gesture and said,
"We'll do it for him."
With that, he burst out laughing. It was the first time Marius had seen him laughing. His laugh was faint and chilling and gave Marius goosebumps. Jondrette opened a cupboard next to the fireplace and pulled out an old cap, which he slapped on his head after whacking it on his sleeve to dust it.
"Now," he said, "I'm off. I've still got people to see, good people. You'll see how it all works out. I won't stay out any longer than I have to. It's quite a hand to play. Look after the house for us."
And with his fists thrust in the pockets of his pants, he stood there thinking for a moment, then cried,
"You know, it's pretty damn lucky that he didn't recognize me, though. If he'd recognized me on his side, he wouldn't be back. He'd escape our clutches. It's my beard that saved me. My romantic little goatee. My sweet, romantic little goatee."
And he started to laugh again. He went to the window. The snow was still falling, streaking the gray of the sky.
"Lousy weather," he said.
Then he crossed the overcoat over in front.
"The coat's too big, of course. Never mind," he added. "Just as well he left it for me, though, the old bastard. If he hadn't, I would never have been able to go out in this, and the whole thing would have come to naught. Such a near thing, but look how it's worked out."
On that note, he jammed his cap down over his eyes and turned on his heel. He had hardly had time to take a few steps outside when the door opened again and his cunning, feral profile reappeared.
"I forgot," he said. "You're to get a charcoal fire going in the stove."
And he threw into his wife's apron the 5-franc piece that the philanthropist had left him.
"A charcoal fire?"
the woman asked.
"Yes.
How many bushels of charcoal?
2 good ones.
That'll come to 30 sous. With the rest, I'll buy something for dinner.
Like hell you will.
Why not?
Don't you go spending that 100 sous piece.
Why not?
Because I've got something else to buy with it instead.
What?
Something. How much will you need? Where's there an ironmonger's around here?
Rue Mouffetard.
Ah, yes, on the corner of Watchet Street. I can see the shop.
But how much is this thing going to cost, then?
3 francs 50 sous.
There won't be much left for dinner.
Today's one day we won't be eating. We've got better things to do.
Whatever you say, treasure.
At this word from his wife, Jondrette closed the door again, and this time Marius heard his footsteps receding down the tenement hallway and quickly down the stairs. At that moment, the bells of Saint-Médard struck 1. Solus cum solo, in loco remoto, non cogitabantur orare paternoster. However much of a dreamer, Marius was, as we know, a strong and active person. The habits of solitary living, by developing sympathy and compassion in him, had perhaps diminished his capacity for irritation, but left intact his capacity for outrage. He had the benevolence of a Brahmin and the severity of a judge. He might feel sorry for a toad, but he could easily crush a viper underfoot. Now he had just looked down into a viper's hole. It was a nest of monsters, and it was right under his nose. "I'll have to stamp on these miserable bastards," he said. None of the puzzles he'd hoped would be cleared up had been illuminated. On the contrary, they had all, perhaps, become even more opaque. He knew nothing more about the beautiful girl from the Luxembourg Gardens or about the man he called Monsieur Leblanc, except that Jondrette knew who they were. Through the black words delivered, he glimpsed only one thing at all clearly, and that was that an ambush was being set up. An obscure but terrible ambush. That they were both in serious danger, she probably, her father for sure. That they had to be saved, that the hideous schemes of the Jondrettes had to be undone and the web of these spiders torn down. He observed Mother Jondrette for a moment. She pulled an old cast-iron stove from out of a corner and was rummaging round in the scrap. He got down from the chest of drawers as quietly as he could, being careful not to make a sound. In his dread of what was being set up, and in the horror into which the Jondrettes had plunged him, he felt a kind of joy that it might perhaps be given to him to do a great service to the one he loved. But what could he do? Warn the people under threat? Where would he find them? He didn't have an inkling of their address. One minute they were there, before his very eyes, the next minute they were gone again, driven back into the unfathomable depths of Paris. Wait for Monsieur Leblanc at the door at 6 o'clock when he was supposed to turn up, and warn him about the trap? But Jondrette and his cronies would see him keeping watch. The place was deserted. They would be stronger than he was. They would find a way of nabbing him and carting him off. And the man Marius wanted to save would be sunk. 1 o'clock had just sounded. The ambush was to take place at 6. Marius had 5 hours ahead of him. There was only one thing for it. He put on his presentable coat, tied a scarf around his neck, grabbed his hat, and went out, without making any more noise than if he had been walking barefoot on moss. In any case, Mother Jondrette was still rattling around in her iron scrap. Once he was out of the house, he headed for the Rue du Petit Banquier. He was about halfway down the street, level with a very low wall that you could step over in certain places, and that bordered a patch of wasteland, and he was walking along slowly, preoccupied as he was, the snow muffling his footfalls, when, all of a sudden, he heard voices talking quite close by. He turned his head. The street was deserted. There was nobody. It was broad daylight. And yet he could distinctly hear voices. It occurred to him to look over the wall. There were, in fact, 2 men there leaning against the wall, squatting in the snow, and talking in whispers to each other. These 2 figures were not known to him. One was a bearded man in a smock, and the other was a long-haired man in rags. The bearded one had a Greek skullcap, the other was bareheaded, and there was snow in his hair. By leaning over them, Marius could hear what they said. The long-haired one dug the other one in the ribs and said, "With patron in it, you can't go wrong." "You think so?" said the bearded one, and the long-haired one replied, "It'll mean 500 big ones each."
And the worst that can happen? 5 years, 6 years, 10 at the most.
The other man replied with some hesitation, scratching his head under his Greek cap. That sounds pretty solid. A person can't turn down a job like that.
I tell you, the deal can't fail, the long-haired one resumed. Old man, what's his name? He'll make sure the chaff cutter's hitched and hot to trot.
Then they started talking about a melodrama they'd seen the night before at the Gaîté. Marius continued on his way. It seemed to him that the obscure words of these men, so strangely hidden behind the wall, crouching in the snow, were perhaps not unrelated to the abominable plans of Jondrette. That must be the deal they were referring to. He headed for the Faubourg Saint-Marceau and asked at the first shop he came to where he could find the prefect of police. He was directed to the Rue du Pontoise, number 14. Marius went straight there. As he passed a baker's, he bought a bread roll for 2 sous and ate it, foreseeing that he would not eat dinner. On the way, he gave Providence its due. He thought how, if he had not handed over his 5 francs that morning to the Jondrette girl, he would have followed Monsieur Leblanc's cab and, as a result, been completely in the dark. Then nothing would have stood in the way of the Jondrette's ambush, and this Monsieur Leblanc would have been lost, and, doubtless, his daughter with him. Where a police officer gives a lawyer a couple of punches. When he got to number 14 Rue du Pontoise, he went up to the first floor and asked for the prefect of police. "The police chief isn't in," said an office boy. "But there's an inspector standing in for him. Would you like to speak to him? Is it urgent?" "Yes," said Marius. The office boy took him to the commissioner's room. A tall man was standing there behind a metal gate, leaning toward a stove and holding up with both hands the tails of a vast coachman's overcoat with a triple cape. He had a square face with a thin mouth and strong, wild, bushy, graying sideburns, and a gaze that could turn your pockets inside out. You would have described this gaze as not so much penetrating as boring right through you. The man did not look all that much less ferocious or frightening than Jondrette. A mastiff is occasionally no less alarming to run into than a wolf. "What do you want?" he barked at Marius, without adding "monsieur." "Monsieur the prefect of police? He's not here. I'm standing in for him. It concerns a very confidential matter." "Go on, then, speak. And it's extremely urgent. Then speak fast." The man was calm and brusque, both frightening and reassuring at once. He inspired awe and confidence. Marius told him the story that a person he only knew by sight was to be led that very evening into an ambush, that, living in the room next door to the lair in question, he, Marius Pontmercy, lawyer, had heard the whole plot through the wall, that the rogue who had thought up the trap was one Jondrette by name, that he would have accomplices, probably the Barrière prowlers, among others a certain Panchaud, alias Printanier, alias Bigrenaille, that Jondrette's daughters would be on the lookout, that there was no way to warn the man threatened, given that no one even knew his name, and that, finally, all this was to be carried out at 6 o'clock that very evening at the most deserted point on the Boulevard de l'Hôpital, in the house at number 50-52. At that number, the inspector raised his head and said coldly, "So it's the room at the end of the hall?" "Exactly," said Marius, adding, "Do you know the house?" The inspector remained silent for a moment. Then he answered, warming the heel of his boot in the mouth of the stove, "Apparently." He went on through his teeth, speaking less to Marius than to his cravat. "Sounds like Patron Minette's mixed up in this somewhere." The name struck Marius. "Patron Minette," he said. "I did in fact hear that name mentioned." And he told the inspector of the conversation between the long-haired man and the bearded man in the snow behind the wall of the Rue du Petit Banquier. The inspector muttered, "The long-haired fellow would have to be Brujon, and the bearded fellow would have to be Demilliard, alias Dumilliard." He dropped his eyes again and mused. "As for Father What's-His-Name, I have an inkling who that is. There, I've singed my coat. They always make these stoves too hot.